Hello and welcome to The Curator on Monocle Radio with me, Carlotta Ribello. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be bringing you some of the very best interviews and reports from the past week of coverage on Monocle Radio, with highlights from our studios here in London and from around the world. This week, as the world's largest election starts in India, what can we expect over the next 6 weeks?
The poor, again, surviving day to day, are hoping for jobs, are hoping for some kind of relief from the difficulties that they are facing. And whether they'll take that concern to the ballot box, well, that's really the 970 million voter question.
We'll also get the latest from Russia's war in Ukraine and talk about the escalating tensions in the Middle East as Israel and Iran exchange strikes. Then we report on the ground from Italy, first at the Venice Biennale and then in Milan's Salone del Mobile.
My approach is very simple. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. Do it as simple as you can. Our life is quite complex.
All that and more, and we also be sitting down with the singer and producer Maggie Rogers. That's all ahead over the next hour here on The Curator with me, Carlotta Ribello. So welcome to The Curator. One of the main stories this week has been the election happening in India, which is the world's largest ever. Nearly 1 billion people will cast their ballots over the next 6 weeks. And earlier, Monocle's Chris Chermak was joined by Bangalore-based journalist Maya Sharma to get the latest.
Maya, welcome back to the program. First of all, tell us how Narendra Modi himself has positioned himself in the last month or so. What's his pitch?
Well, he has been traveling around the country, across this huge, enormous country, despite the heat wave on in many regions, 40 degrees plus in many areas. He is definitely the face of the BJP. He is presenting himself as the absolute leader. He's talking about Modi guarantees as the biggest selling point for his party in his bid to come back to power for the third consecutive term. He is attacking the Congress. Much of the campaign of the BJP is about attacking the opposition, including the Congress and other parties, saying that they failed to deliver on many fronts. It has been in many ways a negative campaign, saying what the country suffered under the initial years of Congress rule, although he has, of course, been in power for the last 10 years himself. It's been a very, very volatile campaign indeed, marking, of course, the incarceration behind jail. Many of the opposition leaders are, in fact, in jail, including the Delhi Chief Minister, Arvind Kejriwal, which we talked about last time. He's still in jail, no bail for him. And in that way, Prime Minister Modi is going ahead, going around the country. Of course, campaigning has stopped for the 102 seats, which will be voting tomorrow. Campaigning stopped yesterday. There is a 2-day silent period. But he seems all set to try and take on the electorate and get back power in June when the counting happens.
Well, Maya, as you mentioned there, the last time that we spoke on this show was after the arrest of the opposition leaders from the AAP party that governs New Delhi itself. There is this united opposition alliance, but how has that impacted the opposition coalition more broadly? What's their role at this point? Who's kind of taking the lead?
Well, any coalition, of course, does have its ups and downs. But I would say that over the past few weeks, the opposition, known as the India bloc, has been able to get its act more or less together. They are working as a team, except in some states like the southern Indian state of Kerala, where they are fighting against each other for power. But elsewhere, they've been able to present a united front. They're talking about the common themes together. Their biggest thrust, really, has been the decline in democracy, what they see as a decline in democracy in India, the targeting, of course, of opposition leaders, of themselves, of party accounts being frozen, leaders being put into prison. But they're also talking about an attempt to divide the country, an attempt to actually make communities fight against each other. They say this divisive politics is what really marks the BJP, and they're using that a lot. They're also attacking the government on issues of unemployment. Unemployment figures in India are uncomfortably high. They're talking about inflation. They're talking about corruption behind electoral bonds, which was a rather dubious method of funding political parties. They are taking on the government, the ruling party, on those fronts, and they have been able to present a more or less united front in the last few weeks leading up to the voting itself.
Well, I wanted to touch on the economy, but before we get to that, this democracy aspect that you say the opposition is raising, how successful has that been? I mean, it's something that we also focus on, outside of India, but is it reaching through to voters? What are their main issues that are making them passionate about this election?
Well, unemployment is a huge factor, and many people are finding it very difficult to manage with inflation and trying to keep pace with the rise in the cost of living. But unfortunately, I think in many ways, this whole debate on democracy is restricted, as often happens elsewhere in the world as well, to social media. The people who are complaining about it may be talking echo chambers, they may be preaching to the converted. But there is definitely a point being raised, at least on social media, and in some of the increasingly shrinking number of media houses who are ready to take on the government, talking about the decline in democratic values in the country of India. That is an issue. I'm not really sure if it's resonating with the person on the ground who is concerned about his or her income, the food, the money they're getting for the crops they're growing. I think the economy is really a bigger issue for them. But Narendra Modi, of course, presenting figures saying that things are much, much better under the NDA rule, that is the coalition of the BJP and other parties. He's saying that they have done much better than the Congress-led coalition which preceded them.
Well, that's what I wanted to get into when it came to the economy as well. What is your sense there, too, of how voters are feeling? There are sort of multiple sides to this, aren't there? Because India's economy in terms of growth is doing very well. It has grown to become the fifth largest economy in the world. But as you mentioned, unemployment is particularly high. So what is your sense of whether Modi will be rewarded for his handling of the economy?
Well, I think India, perhaps more than any other country in the world, it's a place where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. The bulk of the wealth is concentrated in the top few percent of people. I mean, the rich are getting enormously, almost obscenely rich, if I could say that. And there are charges of crony capitalism also against Prime Minister Modi and the BJP itself, that the government in power has been favouring big, big corporate houses in terms of allotting them contracts, in terms of maybe even twiddling the laws a bit to make it more, to make their businesses more profitable. That is, of course, a huge charge. And definitely the middle class, who may have been seeing their investments grow in the stock market, who've been seeing the growth in their savings, may think we're onto a good thing here. Why rock the boat? Let's let Modi come back. In casual talk, you hear people saying invest now because after the election, the market's really going to go even higher. That is the sense among the middle class and among the wealthy. The poor, again, surviving day to day, are hoping for jobs, are hoping for some kind of relief from the difficulties that they are facing. And whether they'll take that concern to the ballot box, well, that's really the 970 million voter question.
Just finally, to follow up on that, Maya, quickly, you almost give the sense there that Modi is not that particularly popular. I mean, if there is something then that you would focus on to say why he is going to get a third term, what is it?
He has been stressing on the whole Hindutva concept, the whole feeling that Hindus, the Hindu majority in the country, is in danger. He has created an enemy among the minorities of the country and saying that they are perhaps, he of course denies this, he of course says he isn't, but there is a perception that the BJP is actually dividing the country along religious lines, and that by trying to consolidate the Hindu voters into a feeling of we are there to protect you, we are there to keep you safe, that may be playing on the minds of many voters who feel, yes, we need this kind of protection. We have in the campaign, we've seen BJP leaders firing imaginary arrows at a masjid. We've heard hate speeches against minorities. We've seen all that. We are still witnessing it in the campaigning itself. So that could be a way he is reaching people. He opened that huge Rama Mandir, the Ram temple, back in January. And in fact, just yesterday, it was Ram Navami, the celebration of the birthday of Lord Rama, observed by many Hindus. So he's tied up religion a lot with his campaigning, with his politics. And that does seem to be working in many areas of the country.
Now, Ukraine's recent attacks on Russian oil refineries have deepened tensions with the US. But can Kyiv risk a rift with the White House as Washington battles internal political divides over the war in Ukraine? It comes days after President Volodymyr Zelensky made a virtual plea to the Delphi Economic Forum for additional military aid from Western nations, stopping short of calling for troops on the ground. Monocle's team was at the event and caught up with the former commander of U.S. Army Europe, Ben Hodges. Andrew Mueller began by asking Ben whether he thinks Ukraine could win this war without the assistance of foreign troops.
Absolutely, I do. But of course, the key caveat is that they need ammunition, they need the sanctions that the West has imposed on Russia, those need to be enforced. All of those things have to happen. And you know, you remember last time we spoke, I've been an optimist about this, about Ukraine's prospects for winning, but I always caveated that by if we provide what's needed. And clearly, we in the U.S. are failing miserably right now. You can't blame it just on the Republicans, although they deserve most of the blame. The administration also has failed to make clear why this is important for the United States, that Ukraine wins. And the president has to do a much better job of that.
I mean, I do want to come back to the American political aspect of this shortly, but you alluded to it there. And there has been this suggestion from President Emmanuel Macron of France, echoed by Poland's Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski, among others, and they weren't saying we will or we should or we might. They were just saying we're not going to rule it out. From where we are now, does it strike you as a completely incredible prospect that one or more NATO nations might decide to actually act on the ground in Ukraine?
Not at all. I think, first of all, what President Macron said was really important strategically. You know, it puts the Russians on the back foot a little bit. I mean, I don't know why my president over 2 years ago said no U.S. boots on the ground. Why would you say that? Even if you never intended to send somebody. Mm. I mean, that's an invitation to Russia. Whenever you tell somebody what you're not going to do. And so for President Macron to say, you know, we should not take that off the table, I thought that was very good. And it also got the conversation going about it. And now it seems much more plausible, not likely, plausible. When you start thinking, well, what are we talking about? Maybe we're talking about air defenders, we're talking about engineers, communications, logistics, etc. But I tell you what, I think it is a very real possibility now, because countries, in particularly in Eastern Europe, cannot just sit at the border and hope that Russia runs out of gas before they get to Moldova or Poland or Lithuania. Mm. I wouldn't make a prediction for other countries, but I don't know how they could not get involved if it looks like Russia is going to get across the Dnieper and it's just going to keep going somehow.
So is the only reason, though, not to do that, the Russian nuclear deterrent?
I think we have been deterring ourselves out of an unnecessary fear of Russian use of a nuclear weapon for years now. I think, of course, Russia has thousands of nuclear weapons. Of course, they don't care how many innocent people might die. Mm-hmm. But there's no value for them in using a nuclear weapon. Their nuclear weapons are most effective when they don't actually use them. You know, it's the threat. Mm. Because they see how all of us are like, oh, my God, they might escalate. And so I think Poland or France or Lithuania or other European countries will do what's in their best interest. If that means helping stop Russia from defeating Ukraine, I think that they will do it. The countries that are closest to Russia physically that would suffer the most from any nuclear strike are the ones that are most clear-eyed about the threat and the need mm-hmm. to do something.
Another conflict we did speak about last time, and I do want to ask you about again, having moved on a few months, is obviously the one between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. You have, of course, an unusual insight into that as someone who has seen urban combat up close. You commanded a brigade of the 101st Airborne at the Battle of Najaf in 2003. When you look at what the IDF have done since we last spoke about this, are you surprised by how they have gone about their business in Gaza?
I'm not surprised how they've done it, because they have done this, maybe not on this scale, but they have done this for many years. I think what I'm a little bit surprised about is how thus far they have pretty much dismissed criticism from the U.S. and other European countries. The countries that typically have supported Israel in the past are really, you know, my president certainly has put a lot of pressure on them, and so far I can't tell that it's had any impact. That's a little bit of a surprise to me, which means that the Netanyahu government does not take serious stern warnings coming from Secretary Blinken or President Biden. So I think the ultimate leverage is going to have to be when the U.S. says Israel cannot use any weapons or ammunition for any operations in Gaza, for example, or anything in support of illegal settlements or something that one could describe as in support of the greater Israel ideology.
Mm. But is what we're seeing at all comparable to anything you recall from Iraq? Or are they? Does it strike you that this is just the complete scorched earth approach?
Well, I mean, look, everybody in the world knows that Hamas is a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. They're brutal. And that they use innocent people as human shields. There's no denying that. But that doesn't mean that the IDF can then just go ahead and destroy entire houses without confirming that only Hamas are inside of it. You can't do that. The hundreds of weapons that have been dropped from aircraft or have been fired from artillery, you can't just do that without killing innocent people. You know, American soldiers, British soldiers, all of us in Afghanistan and Iraq had put our own guys at risk until we could confirm that only Taliban, for example, or Al-Qaeda were in a structure. Of course we made mistakes. Mm. Those are mistakes. This is a deliberate, I think, a willingness to accept a level of collateral damage because it was really worth it to get this particular guy. That's illegal. That's unacceptable. And I think it becomes very, very difficult for the government to justify it, and it's become even more difficult for friends of Israel to continue to support it.
You're listening to The Curator on Monocle Radio. I'm Carlotta Ribello. This week also saw a major escalation in the conflict in the Middle East, with Israel striking Iran in what claims it was a retaliation. Just as the news of the overnight attack came through, we got the latest from the Iranian journalist, broadcaster and former presenter at the BBC's Persian service, Negin Shigarayeh.
Right now, from the chatter and from the pattern of behavior, we might be able to say there is no interest in escalating to a full war right now. You know, it's all of the Iranian media are controlled by the government. And since the attack last week, even the social media became completely controlled. If you post anything that is going against the regime, they can arrest you. So understanding exactly what are the different types of views within the government and outside the government, it's almost impossible right now. But at the same time, they've been downplaying the attack and they haven't created, like, they look at it as a failure right now. And they're saying it was small drones, they didn't do any damage, and in completely trying to calm down the situation. And I think from that we can say, and from the pattern of behavior, that for Iran, with the situation that it is in, especially economic situation and other problems that it has inside the country, there's no interest in full-on war right now. They're going to drag the tension, and that's in their interest, to play with their proxies in the region, to poke here and there and make the tension rising. But I think that's a long-term plan, not the quick response.
And as we heard from Chris Lord a moment ago, the reports of what happened overnight suggest that the aerial defence systems of Iran are certainly not as good as Israel's. I mean, how vulnerable is Iran here?
The interesting thing is this area, the Isfahan that was attacked, it's not the first time Israelis attacked to that area. There are incidents of attack throughout years. And the interesting thing is to understand exactly what happened today, because it seems like every time the attacks are targeting more directly different parts of the military equipments or the bases that are around that area. And if this time, I just read an article on Washington Post that was claiming the Israelis send a signal to the Iranians that if we want to attack your nuclear facilities, we can by this attack. And then the Iranians are saying these are like really small drones. We managed it really easily. There's like no problem and all of it. And from that denial, you can kind of read between the lines that Israelis might have sent a stronger signal that we
are seeing right now, that they can attack the nuclear facilities if they want to. And they send a strong signal to the Iranians to stop escalating and otherwise we're going to attack. Although I do believe that it's interest of both countries to both governments, not the countries, both governments to not escalate more than this right now, because both of these governments got what they wanted from this tension. Netanyahu is, got the support inside and outside Israel. Also, the Iranian regime managed to crack down inside the country because, there's a police state right now in the country.
Indeed, tell us a little bit more about how Iranians are reacting to what's going on.
So the Islamic Republic, the government, it's interesting. So from the consulate attack, it seems like there was a plan on how to respond to it. The attack to Israel on Saturday was completely planned. They sent a message to the American and Israelis that we are going to attack, so be prepared. And at the same time, inside the country, they started this big new project on attacking, on cracking down on women who are disobeying the government and not wearing mandatory hijab. So this, on Saturday morning, the police state in all around the country was in place. The police vans were arresting women. A lot of violent scenes came out. So that fear and police state was in place. And then overnight, they attacked. Right now, it's really difficult to understand, what exactly is happening. They managed to control the flow of information in a way that they never managed to do before up to this point, especially with the social media. You know, you get the post, someone posts something. But even for this attack, we got some pictures from, the Isfahan, some UGCs, user-generated pictures, but it's really limited. And that begs the question that how much they have control over the flow of information right now, and what is the real picture inside the country?
Tell me, finally, Negin, about the wider position of Iran and its partners within the region. As we heard from Chris a little earlier on, we are now looking at the likes of Jordan and the US and France and the UK who intervened when Iran launched its drone and missile attack on Saturday night. What are Iran's partners now saying about what needs to be done next?
Iran's partner mostly are not states, so it's smaller groups and military groups, proxies. And I think there is in all of these equations, we shouldn't forget the economical situation of Iran. So we've heard around the news round of sanctions. The economy of the country is in danger. And all of these proxies are relying on money to be able to carry out the attacks they want to do. So I think it's not easy for Iran, for those groups to just operate on their own. They need the weaponry and, the consulate and the money the Iranians are sending them. And I don't think anyone is ready to react in the way that we are worried right now about. But I think at the same time, Iran is counting on Israel attacking more attacks on Gaza and the Palestinian people. And that's going to create a kind of atmosphere that Iran can use in its own advantage, because a lot of people in the Arab countries are really dissatisfied with the way their countries are responding to the Israeli attack on Gaza. And Iran is counting on banking on that and use that later on in response to Israel. And if it comes to it, they can create a kind of destabilities across the region.
Another country that had elections this week was Croatia, and we got the results from our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaney.
Guy, at the very least, the HDZ would appear to have had their wings clipped. Any particular reason why?
Well, the main reasons which are cutting through, the main issues that were cutting through in terms of the anti-HDZ vote were corruption, inflation and young people leaving the country, all of which you could say were connected. But you've got, as President Zoran Milanovic was saying today, and he's no friend of the HDZ, as you probably know, he was saying that, well, two-thirds of the country voted against the HDZ. And that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but there's something in that. If you've got a party which is the natural party of government in a country, but one which has got an issue in that in the past the party itself has been convicted of corruption. It had a prime minister who served jail time for committing corruption while in office, and it has this image that it runs something of a clientelist operation, that you have to be connected with the HDZ if you want to get on in certain spheres in life. That's problematic for a lot of people in Croatia, and they don't feel too good about it. So if you want to vote against that sort of thing, you would vote for someone other than the HDZ.
Guy, you invoke there the rambunctious, if not downright rambunctious, figure of President Milanovic. He has played a debatably constitutional role in this election. Is there a widespread opinion that he has had his thumb on the scales to an untoward degree?
I don't know if he's had his thumb on the scales in terms of how things have worked out with the election. What he did during the election campaign was probably fairly unconstitutional, because, as you point out, the Constitutional Court banned him from standing as a candidate for Prime Minister, and that would have been for the coalition led by the centre-left SDP. And he said that was a rotten thing for them to do, called them peasants, and then went around the country campaigning but not campaigning. You know, he wasn't officially a part of the election campaign, but he was saying rude things about the HDZ at every turn, which would then be put to members of the HDZ, including Prime Minister Andrei Plenković, and they would then have to respond to Mr. Milanovic's comments, and thus this campaigning but not campaigning worked quite nicely. What it appears to have done is maybe three different things. One, produced a much bigger turnout, one of the biggest turnouts that we've seen in the history of Croatia's elections. Not the largest ever, but one of the biggest. Secondly, it seems to have improved matters for the SDP. Before Mr. Milanovic became involved in their campaign, they were polling at around 13% and looking at getting 20-odd seats in the parliament. They've got 42, which isn't much more than they got last time round, but it's a lot better than they would have got if perhaps Mr. Milanovic hadn't got involved. But the other theory that's flying round is that Mr. Milanovic got everyone out. And he is a bit of a Marmite, or should I say to you, Andrew, Vegemite figure. He is not everybody's cup of meat. And people who don't want a Milanovic-led government, because that was what he was threatening would happen, also turned out and perhaps made sure that they voted for parties that they thought would prevent Milanovic from becoming the head of the next government.
So, Guy, as briefly as possible, which I know is always a dreadful phrase to invoke whenever Balkan politics are involved, what does look like the likeliest governing coalition to come out of this?
It is a big mess at the moment. The HDZ will probably have to eat, or at least Andrei Plenković may have to eat humble pie, and get in bed with the Homeland Movement, the right-wing nationalists of whom he has said very rude things in the not-so-distant past. His job may indeed be on the line because of this. On the other hand, the other possibility that's floating around at the moment is a minority government, which would have Mr. Milanovic, the president, who is now the president, as prime minister. And that would be supported by a lot of parties who wouldn't get into a formal coalition together. So it would basically be an anti-HDZ government with very little ideological common ground, apart from the fact that none of those parties are the HDZ.
Now, all week, the radio team have been in Milan covering Salone del Mobile, the world's largest furniture fair held at the Rho Fairgrounds. Ending this week, the fair showed a variety of events and exhibitions taking place across the city as part of what is officially known as Milan Design Week. Monocle's design editor Nick Moniz spoke to Matteo Thun, founder of Matteo Thun & Partners. The architect and designer is celebrating 40 years of the firm with their new book, Stories, documenting the fascinating stories that have emerged from this exciting journey through life. Nick started by asking him about the importance of telling stories to those who are not in the field of design.
First of all, I believe in wood. I believe that the construction material of this century is wood, and concrete is completely over. I'm just back from Japan and I've seen a lot of concrete architecture. I think it doesn't last well. The patina of wood is creating a wonderful surface, and after hundreds and hundreds of years, wood is always better and nicer.
So your materials, I guess, are a priority for you going forward?
Our message in the office is timeless sensoriality. And sensoriality, that's all about. I mean, look at the Japanese or look at the Korean shows happening this week. Everybody's talking about Japan, everybody's talking about Korea, and everybody is looking for sensoriality.
And what does sensoriality, including fashion. What does sensoriality mean? What we experience?
I want to touch. I want to touch with my eyes. I want to feel with my fingers.
So it's about, I guess, wanting people to engage with the architecture, with the furniture.
With furniture, with design, with architecture, there is no difference because sensoriality belongs to the small scale and the big scale.
And you, because you also said timelessness there as well. What does timelessness mean for you as an architect? How do you design for timelessness?
Timeless, first of all, means try to avoid design. Design with the big D or the big A of big architecture. I really don't like architecture that lasts for a few years and then it's over. That means even if we are not published now, we are going to publish hopefully in 100 years.
So, I mean, how do you set about making an architecture that doesn't get tired, that is still relevant after a few years' time? What are some of the approaches you use?
My approach is very simple. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. Do it as simple as you can. Our life is quite complex.
So if we have simple architecture, we want to keep using it, we want to keep it around, we want to spend time in it. Is that your sort of...
Bravo, bravo, you understood.
I passed the test. I mean, so we've got timeless sensoriality. I mean, what are there other hallmarks, are there other like traits that you've learned over the past 40 years that you always bring into your work?
Yes, try to reduce, try to become simpler, try to... do it as simple as you can because construction sites are quite complex. And reducing complexity means reducing the engineering approach is far too complex. And as an architect, we have to avoid that complexity starts with over-engineering.
And if we stop over-engineering, we come back to that simplicity, which gives it timelessness. Is that sort of... it's all kind of linked together.
It's linked together. Bravo.
I mean, can I get a job at your architecture studio? It feels like we're on the same wavelength here. Is that a possibility?
Let's try.
Okay. I've got an internship coming up. I mean, I guess, but just finally, are there any... Yeah, big messages. You know, we've got a big audience that include a lot of designers, but also people that aren't designers. I mean, are there any, I guess, messages that you're hoping you want to get out through this book? We have sort of touched on it, but I guess, what are the takeaways? Why should somebody buy or pick up a copy of Stories by Matteo Thun?
First of all, I think curiosity is definitely given because a lot of stories, even my wife and my children don't know. So it's a lot of new things to discover. And definitely, as a non-architect, this book is going to be more interesting. I think architects are always interested in architecture, and that's not my case.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
UBS.
You're with The Curator, our weekly highlights show here on Monocle Radio. I'm Carlotta Ribello. Our team was also on the ground at the Venice Biennale, alongside, of course, the art world. Taking over the imposing neoclassical pavilion of Great Britain is the artist John Akomfra. Entitled Listening All Night to the Rain, his commission engages with the themes of memory, racial injustice and climate change. Through the use of sound and video, he's filled the space in a way that encourages visitors to consider the act of listening in new ways. Monocle's Robert Bound tells us about the journey visitors go through as they experience the pavilion.
One of the things that always sort of seemed slightly anticlimactic about the pavilion is that you came in from the top. There was this grand staircase. You walked up. I mean, I've been coming here for 25 years, so I've experienced it a lot. And you come in, and there's this huge hall, and you kind of realize that about usually a third of it, maybe more, is taken up with texts. And then the rest is given over to a piece of work. And then after that, it sort of seems to me to go slightly downhill because the rest of the spaces are quite small, you know. So it always felt like this slightly weird, anticlimactic thing. And I was concerned about how one could reverse that logic so that the denouement to the show was the larger spaces, or at least the kind of crescendo was in the larger space, and then you tapered off slightly. And that suggested to me that one of the things you did was to close the front and have people come through the basement into it. So you have a piece in the basement, and then you come up from the basement. Now, you know, as you know, with anything to do with English public or private life, basements are important. and this is no exception. So I wanted to doff my cap to that.
There's all sorts of ways of taking that, the below stairs kind of vibe, and where the bodies are buried, and all sorts of things that you are riffing.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you come in and you are immersed in liquidity, in water. But you're immersed in liquidity and water with objects and photographs and sonic artifacts and paintings and all trying to allude to this sense that water might have a memorial function, might have a way of retaining memory, which was actually a debate once in the 80s, a scientific debate about whether or not water can possess and retain memory. It was suggested by someone who was then rubbished by the scientific community, Jacques Benveniste in 88, but I love it as a kind of poetic concept. It might not be true scientifically, but it feels right to me poetically.
And there's a lot of, and water is all about, in that, it sounds like harking back to that original Chinese text, John, the idea of moving, you know, it's how we moved around the world before aeroplanes. We're in Venice, a none more wet town, I suppose, as well. And also a place of migration, of trade, of all the, you know, these palaces and churches and amazing squares were built on that sort of stuff. This work seems perfect for here, in terms of kind of speaking to the, shouting out from the Giardini to the rest of the town. It's definitely in conversation with it. I'd love to know a bit about the making a work specifically for this building, for this artistic engagement at the Biennale here in 2024, actually.
Well, I mean, any conversation with Venice is completely unintended. I have to say that because
I thought you were just wearing wellies the whole time.
I feel like I'm being fake if I say, oh, we were doing this in conversation with Venice. Hell no. We were doing this in conversation with Brit culture, for sure, but definitely not Venice. I mean, I, you know, halfway through I was like, oh, okay, man, Venice, water, oh, okay. But it wasn't where it started. You know, I was looking for a vessel.
It's not like the portrait of the Queen on a £20 note, smiling back at you. Watermark.
I was looking for a vessel that might function as a kind of motif for how memory works, the fluidity of it, the randomness of it, the seeming serenity of it. You know, all of those seem to me to be ways in which one can suggest the presence of memory. But I was doing that because we were tracking the ghost of listening. I wanted to do something about listening in a visual form. And it seemed to me that listening, at the very least, harked to something called memory. Because to listen is to be transported elsewhere. You know, when you listen, you're immediately, whatever it is, rain or music, or you're immediately placed elsewhere. So how to visualize the elsewhere then became the task, basically. And water was important for that.
Now, if you are in Italy for Salone del Mobile and need some recommendations, you should stop by one of its many latterie. Monocle's Chiara Romella gives you her top tips.
Many of those who will be headed to Milan soon for Salone del Mobile might be heartbroken at the news that La Latteria di San Marco, known to most simply as La Latteria, has shuttered its doors. This unassuming pint-sized trattoria in Brera had become something of a go-to for the people who frequent the northern Italian city for their creative pursuits, be it fashion, design or art. And that's even if only a handful of people could sit down at each service and that booking in advance was impossible. There was something about this place. For over 50 years, owners Maria and Arturo Maggi ran it like their home kitchen, and this inevitably attracted punters. The brusque, old-school but warm style of their hospitality did it, coupled with its seemingly incongruous interiors, which combined mock Portuguese tiles with plentiful floral prints. Then there was the food, simple and traditional, starting from its hallowed lemon and bottarga spaghetti, but with an eccentric side. Chef Arturo Maggi had a thing for cooking in silver skillets because of a personal fascination with alchemy and the properties of metal. Still, the good news is that not all is lost, and not just because rumour has it that the owners, who have decided to retire, are on the lookout for someone trustworthy to take over the business. Most importantly, not everyone who went to La Latteria realised that this wasn't, in fact, the only latteria in Milan, and that there are plenty of similarly down-to-earth establishments to be discovered hidden away across the city. The latterie, or milk shops, were actually born in Milan at the end of the 19th century as places where the bounty of the surrounding region's dairy farms could be sold to the public. Soon enough, these retailers started turning into places where people could eat a humble lunch, featuring the shop's own cheeses, of course, at very affordable prices. Their dishes were basic, their ambiance often sparse, all marble tables and walls lined with white tiles, and yet, they became popular meeting points for anybody from factory workers to penniless intellectuals. On the menu, you'd find simple home-style dishes like vegetable soup and meatballs, or large mugs of milky coffee for dipping bread in, and summery cones of whipped cream dusted with cinnamon. The latterie entered the golden era in the post-war years when Italians had little money to spare, but by the 1970s, their presence started being threatened. As is often the case for this kind of traditional enterprise, the advent of supermarkets forced many such businesses to shutter across town. And yet, some latterie managed to survive and are still alive today. You'll find most of them in the neighbourhoods just outside the city centre, hiding behind their vintage-looking signage. There's Latteria Carrara, whose meatball sandwiches are particularly popular with the students of the university opposite, or Latteria Carlon, famous for its breaded swordfish that's a staple on the menu every Friday. And then there's Latteria Cicala, the image of an old-school Italian eatery with its red checker tablecloths, or Latteria Maffucci, which ventures outside the confines of traditional Lombardy cooking, given its owners are Sardinian. At La Latteria in Via Stendhal, things are decidedly Milanese. You can try the city's traditional saffron risotto here, whilst La Vecchia Latteria is slightly unconventional in its all-vegetarian offering. It's been pioneering this cuisine since the 1970s, when plant-based eating wasn't really all that common. But going to a latteria in Milan isn't just about nostalgia. Some entrepreneurs around town have decided to rethink these institutions, opening new restaurants that pay homage to the past while also bringing things up to date. Mimmo Russo's Latteria 1952 in Porta Genova is one of them. In this exposed brick space, which opened its doors in 2022, time-honoured recipes are modernised and there's room for some experiments too.
The Latteria 1952 was born, as the name suggests, in 1952, when the Latteria in Via Stendhal originally opened. We took it over in 1998 and later opened this restaurant in a new site. We wanted to deploy a kind of innovation that ensures tradition is kept. But at the same time, the Latteria needed to express itself in a different way, to make people who frequent the Latteria understand that other than presenting traditional dishes, we can also make gourmet dishes. The same goes for cocktails. Over the years, traditional latteria never made cocktails. It just sold milk or made home-style dishes. At best, you could have aperitivo, something like Aperol or Rabarbaro liquor, or things like that.
Updating tradition doesn't necessarily mean revolutionizing recipes. It's more about finding small ways of making improvements to cooking techniques and playing around with all aspects of a meal, from food to drink.
For us, tradition shouldn't be messed with. For example, our risotto alla milanese is made exactly as it was born. Innovation and tradition marry at the latteria when we pair the dishes we have created with traditional dishes and the world of mixology. So you could come to us and eat a risotto while drinking a gin tonic.
But perhaps the most relevant way in which the new latteria can stay true to tradition is in respecting the spirit and role these institutions played in Milan's neighborhoods.
When we took over the latteria in 1998, we always tried to maintain those strong points that made the latteria popular all around Milan. The fact there were points of aggregation that sold good food. We maintained that philosophy. Community is the most important thing. Coming to the latteria doesn't mean sitting down and spending 10, 20, 50, 100 euros. There's no such thing as an average bill for us. We brought the philosophy of the old latteria into the new latteria.
So whether you choose to stick to old school or go for an updated version of the classic, there's plenty of latteria still left to explore across Milan. Milk them while you can. For Monocle in Milan, I am Chiara Rimella.
And finally on today's Curator, we meet American singer and songwriter and producer Maggie Rogers, who shot to fame after a 2016 video showed her wowing Pharrell Williams with her track Alaska. She met Monocle's Robert Bound to discuss her new album and much more.
So close the door, change the channel, give me something I can handle. I could love her or someone that's nice to me. Take my money, wreck my Sundays.
Can you hear yourself when you listen back to the record, when you listen back to Don't Forget Me, can you hear the kind of levity and fun and that kind of, hang on, is this a demo, these demos, or is this an album?
Totally.
Can you hear that back
oh
in your
God.
Own voice, your own playing, the joy that comes off the,
so much.
Off the recording?
Well, first of all, my friends who have heard it have all said that it sounds like the version of me that they know.
Okay, nice.
So that like unguarded, loose nature is really there. Mm. But also like at the end of track two is the song called Drunk. At the end, there's this moment where you can hear both Ian and I like, woo!
Yeah.
Like, just like, you know, you that moment when you've just written a song and you're playing it live for the end and for the first you're playing it for the first time and you get to the end and you're like,
yeah,
yo, this is sick. Like, or like there's a sort of pithy, sassy voicemail in So Sick of Dreaming.
This is the New York Knicks and having two martinis at the
exactly.
bar. And I love that. I mean, that's...
It was this total...
I love the talking bits in any songs, but
yeah,
particularly
I do
that.
Too. Yeah. It was this total bit that I had just like freestyled to make Ian laugh.
Yeah.
As like, I was like, oh, this will be some instrumental section. Someone will take a solo.
Yeah.
And I was just like, give me one take. And I threw it in there. And then it just made us both laugh so much that we kept it. So I think you can hear... There's real sincerity on the record as well.
Yeah.
But the silliness is present, which I think life should be that way.
I love that little talking bit in that track. You sort of looking, I mean, we can talk about the sort of road trip aspect mm-hmm. of the record as well, but this feels maybe to me like you looking back from this convertible at the desert beyond.
Totally.
Well, I say desert.
Yeah,
I don't mean that metaphorically.
Oh, yeah, right. Thank you.
With your scarf blowing in the wind, kissing it goodbye to
some
extent. I love
that image. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of like...
That's the video sorted.
I love it.
Don't worry, no one's ever done it before.
Right. There's definitely some like Thelma and Louise within the backdrop and the landscape of this record.
Yeah.
But it wasn't consciously looking back when I wrote it. I mean, when I wrote it, this sort of character and this narrative started to appear, and I started writing it as if I was writing scenes in a movie that took place over like 48 hours or something, you know, like she goes to the bar and she makes out with this guy and she's not really stoked about it, but she did it. And then on the walk home, what does she feel? Oh, she's probably like kind of lonely.
Yeah.
And so like, okay, let's write that song. Like it was a way to just keep us moving and just keep figuring out where to go next, because at, you know, one of the greatest tools in making this record kind of was momentum.
Yeah.
So it was just about keeping gas in the car.
And that thing of writing for a fictitious version of yourself or a version of yourself.
Totally.
Or simply a person that you've imagined doing all these amusing things on this kind of nominal road trip, right? That's a bit like, you know, if you're a soundtrack composer, you've got a film to be soundtracking. Mm-hmm. There's something... And I've asked soundtrack composers about this, and they really like it. They might make pop music as well, but they love having the kind of, you know, the framework. It's great. It's a great thing to write to something. And I'm not suggesting you've done that, but maybe if you've got, there's a storyline that you've kind of, is somewhere in the back of your mind, you can write to that.
It was a part of the process. I mean, I think it's really helpful to have limitations when making art. Because, you know, when I walked into the studio, normally when I go to make a record, I have a sense of like the world I want to build and the colors and the references and sort of the texture and the feel of it. Mm-hmm. And this record, because I had just put out Surrender, I sort of walked in being like, I don't know, like, let's see what happens. But I think in that way, as this thing started coming forward, I didn't have to second guess it because there was no pressure to even make anything in the first place. Like it was all bonus.
Yeah.
And then when I walked away from the studio a couple of days later and got home and sort of started to listen and process what I had made, I was sort of like, oh, I think we're done. Like, it was just like a real surprise.
What should I do? Okay, that's the album done. What should I do, like, next week?
Go on tour for my last record was the answer. I mean, then I got to go tour Surrender, you know?
Yeah.
So there was so much, in so many ways, the time from writing this record to releasing it, like, I've grown and changed so much. And I always think you do kind of grow into a record.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about the moment in your life that it meets the world where there's some like alchemical thing that happens where you sort of start to
you
line
and the record
up.
Osmosis, you kind of like squelch together to become this thing. Well, that's how it seems from the record buyers, the writers.
Sure.
Point of view, you know, we love to put people in boxes and it's like, this is the sophomore really album. Do. This is the, she did this. This is who she is now. Which is
funny because
rude and wrong.
Well,
often, but
I think that, you know, genre or those boxes often just exist to sell music and to help people understand them, which part of that is frustrating and part of that is deeply understandable. And then I think the other thing about records is it is weird because you're writing down these like super vulnerable truths about your life, but they don't really come out till like a year and a half later. So by the time you are like embodying this person, you've probably moved on in the same way that, like, you know, I now have about shoulder length, normal, natural hair that really feels like this record.
We can concur that.
Yeah. Okay. It's confirmed. When I made this record, I had like a tiny bleach pixie cut, which was really what Surrender felt like. So it's funny that, like, I don't know. I don't think that there is a hard line. I think you're sort of becoming it all the time.
Yeah.
But there are definitely parts of this record that have like almost come true.
Yeah.
Like the sense of timing, I'm usually always writing about the past. Mm. And this record has this really spooky past, present, future thing built into it where I wrote some songs that have like now become what my life looks like a year and a half ago, like later.
Yeah.
And it's crazy.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Curator. The show was produced by Sam Impey and presented by me, Carlotta Ribello. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of the programs across Monocle Radio. Goodbye and thank you for listening.